Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading. I'm a past president of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and a current member of the club's Board of Governors. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and author of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is a professor of sociology at Georgetown University. He has penned 16 books, including Holler If You Hear Me and Is Bill Cosby Right? His latest offering is April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. Dr. Dyson, who is renowned as one of the country's foremost public intellectuals, is never one to shy from social commentary. He has explored the complicated life of rapper Tupac Shakur and has also taken on iconic heavyweights such as Bill Cosby on issues that face the African-American community. Dr. Dyson joins us this evening to expand on the life and times of one of the most important figures in American history. Where it appears that we live in a time that our society is ready to turn the corner on the long road to racial equality, our national psyche has long battled racial disparities. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life 40 years ago for the sake of unity in an otherwise volatile environment. And tonight, Dr. Dyson will examine King's death and its impact on the past, present, and future of this country. Last night, you may have seen Dr. Dyson on a full segment of CNN's Larry King Live, but tonight, we are very pleased to have him at the Commonwealth Club of California. Please welcome Dr. Michael Eric Dyson.
Thank you, Brother Epstein, for that gracious introduction. Brother Carlos and all the great folk at the Commonwealth Club, I often look forward to coming here when I write a book, if I'm ever honored enough to be invited. And it is a delight and an honor to see all of you here tonight and for us to think together about important social issues. And this is such a great forum for the airing of critical ideas that are central to a civil and civic society. Tonight, as I reflect upon Dr. King's legacy, I suppose one raises immediately the question as to why this particular second book on Martin Luther King Jr. addresses his death when the first one that I wrote in 2000, I may not get there with you, The True Martin Luther King Jr., addressed the way in which his life had been appropriated by various conservative causes and employed to defend ideas that ultimately stood in radical opposition to Dr. King's fundamental beliefs. This particular book addresses Dr. King's engagement with death and the way in which Dr. King's engagement with death had an impact upon the civil rights movement and the subsequent development of strategies designed to secure the freedom and emancipation of black people in America. As such, I divide the book into three sections: Moses, Freedom, Promised Land, or Wilderness, and Joshua. that tripartite division reflects the messianic preoccupations of this iconic figure and the attempt to situate him within the context of competing and rival schemes of rational justification for the pursuit of freedom, justice, and equality by means of a black leadership style that resonated with African-American religious people, and thus to assert King's legitimate claim, his bona fides as a messianic leader, and what that meant in terms of both shaping his own perception of the role of the leader and what was achievable within the context of such a paradigm. To be sure, it has limitations, some of which I explore later on in the book. In this first section, King's vision is examined through the prism of his preoccupation with death, because death was so central to the life of Martin Luther King Jr., ironically enough. It was central because he was seeking to change America, to transform the nation, and for that he was paid back with a constant hounding and harassing, and ultimately a continual stream of invective and resistance directed at him from both white racist hate groups, from pockets of the citizenry, and from official elements within government. J. Edgar Hoover, for instance, constantly told his field agents not to warn Dr. King of credible threats to his life. The very government that was ostensibly to protect civil interests, civil liberties, and the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness was indeed standing in the way, an impediment to the realization of that goal, because it actively conspired with interests that sought to murder Dr. King by refusing to warn him of credible death threats. Mr. Hoover wrote in his peculiar scribble across the field notes of operatives who requested permission to warn Dr. King, "No, he's not worthy." And for those who feel that certain quarters of black America are paranoid and obsessed with the means by which they can be subverted, by which their leadership can be distorted, by which the government instrumentally offsets the legitimate and effective exercise of leadership with its powerful contortions and distortions, need look no further than COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and sending of tapes to Dr. King's wife and sending him notes warning him that he should commit suicide rather than continue on in his path. This is not 50 years ago in America where that prevailed. And so I wanted to focus on Dr. King's use of death. Its inevitability struck him as certain and real, and thus Dr. King wanted to turn a necessity into a virtue. Having espied on the horizon of his quickly evaporating life the utter possibility, indeed the utter certainty, that his life would end quickly, he seized upon death as a major means by which to inspire the racial troops who were fighting bitterly in bloody racial trenches in warfare in America. The better angels of our nature were being pursued, to be sure, but Martin Luther King Jr. was working through the mud, the muck, and the mire of America's racial trenches to try to make certain that America could become all that she should become. And so he was obsessed with death because people were trying to kill him. He was obsessed with death because people were obsessed with murdering him. Martin Luther King Jr.'s home was bombed. A shotgun blast tore through it. He was stabbed in his chest. He was pummeled mercilessly by a young white Nazi of 200 in excess pounds. His diminutive 5'7 frame withstanding the blows and then beseeching his acolytes and his colleagues not to hurt this man because they had to find out who he was. So that people saw then that Dr. King's commitment to nonviolence was real. He was hit in the head with a rock in Chicago, where he commented that he had never seen such heinous manifestation and such visible articulation of racial animus as he saw in Chicago, even Mississippi, was not his bad. And so Dr. King eventually began to use the inevitability of death, its certainty, as a means to suggest, if I die, the movement will not die, to draw sharp contrast between the attempt to snuff out the vast and grand movement by stopping one particular life. And so not only his life, but as the roll call of martyrs added up, some of them famous and many of them not, the everyday people who were in the trenches of racial warfare, who sacrificed their life and limb, sometimes their blood, for the perpetuation of a movement of freedom, Dr. King then used that inevitability to summon courage from the troops and to suggest that there would be a contrast between his one particular life and the lives of others who would give up the ghost and the grand movement that would continue to live. But not only that, he used death to remind people that that might be the price they'd have to pay to make certain that America could be all that it should be. People now glutted with amnesia tend to forget that the price paid for the democratic experiment in the 1950s and 60s, especially as it took on a black and brown pigment, came at great cost, mostly to those sainted soldiers who stood in stirring courage against an onslaught of vicious and heinous assault, and from the unrepentant arrogance and the unstinted racism of white hate groups. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The more people attempt to murder me, the grander my vision, the deeper my understanding of the utter necessity of what we are doing." Now, that sounds good on paper, but how it translates in life is rather complicated. Martin Luther King Jr. publicly articulated his courage by saying that after he had a conversion experience one night in his kitchen, when someone called him up and called him a nigger and said they would blow up his house and he thought that he could be taken from his wife and child, he said he had to talk to God like he had never spoken to God before. He had to have a personal experience with God, the likes of which he had never had before. Of course, in writing his thesis, comparing the visions of God in Henry Nelson Wyman, who was a personalist who believed that God intervenes in human history in a particular fashion to affect the profound goings-on of human beings, and Paul Tillich, who believed in a kind of ground-of-being conception of God, the same way that Einstein felt that God wound up the universe and allowed it to go on in a kind of mechanistic deism. Paul Tillich said God was the ground of being, not necessarily a personal being who interposed his or her personality into the affairs of men and women, but the very predicate of existence and the basis from which human beings and human life drew. So Martin Luther King Jr. then came to a sense of God as a personal presence like never before. And he said after that he was not fearful of death. And that was a tremendous public articulation which he gathered around many people who were willing to similarly sacrifice their lives in the effort to make this a better nation. But personally, he struggled. Depression was deep and lasting. Sometimes 3 and 4 days he stayed in his bed because the onslaught was unstinting and unforgiving, unremitting. There it was, Martin Luther King Jr. pitted against the best, the worst, if you will, forces in American society seeking to undermine him as he simply sought to make America be all that it should be. Here it was, Martin Luther King Jr. struggling to make America the pristine, pure land of liberty and the grand ideas for which it was founded, and yet it was muddied in the context of blood and bigotry. The vicious resistance to the figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and everyday brothers and sisters who were walking side by side, locked in arm, opposed in common against the vicious denial of opportunity to join this larger circle of American privilege. All he wanted America to do was to, as he said the night before he died, be true to what you said on paper. If you proclaim it, practice it. If you articulate it, then engage it. If it's the ideal, as T.S. Eliot said, let's also find what he said is the the ideal and the reality on the other side. But he said in between that is the shadow, Mr. Elliott did. And Dr. King often lit a light, a powerful, focused, a very powerful light upon the darkness that yawned between the ideal and the reality. And so in the midst of that, he was constantly being threatened, people calling him out, calling his house, threatening his life. Credible threats to the FBI that weren't passed on, but he knew. One night he was in Mississippi, saying after Cheney, Schwerner, and Gutman, two Jewish brothers and a black brother lost their lives, and saying that perhaps the murderers were right there. And you know, then rumors were spreading that Laurie Pritchard, the sheriff of that particular region, was involved in their murder. And when King said, the murderers are probably still gathered here tonight, Pritchard, standing behind King, said, you're damn right, we're right here. King felt that he might lose his life that night. There was no thin blue line to protect black people who were, and white brothers and sisters who were their compatriots in this grand war, against the will and the determination of those who felt that we must keep America pure, those homegrown American terrorists who in the name of Jesus, not Allah, castrated and murdered and burned black people, who put crosses, religious symbols, on the lawns of those brothers and sisters who themselves, ironically enough, were Christians too. One set of Christians murdering another, and only the state to buffer them. Isn't it interesting then why we can never ultimately embrace this evangelical piety which rests in the authority of the state to be baptized with religion? God forbid that. The wall of separation, ingeniously founded by the fathers of this nation, was exactly appropriate. No religion should be established so that all might flourish, or that none might be adopted. And so Martin Luther King Jr. was in the midst of that. Depression bent his elbow a bit to seek relief, no help. Anesthetizing it through cigarette smoke and others, no help. Seeking to eat his way out of the death and infamy of death that circled him, no relief. The pills doctors offered ceased to work. He had what Andrew Young called a war on sleep. This is the existential price paid by this prophet. We read about him in the press. We celebrate him on the Mount Olympus, if you will, of the pantheon of great heroes of American culture. And yet the price paid by this individual man is both unknown and yet so profound. And so I wanted to explore that in my book, how he spoke death. I talk about his automortality, not his autobiography, the narration of his life, but the narration of his death. And this automortality, this narration of death, is interesting because it's like an Einsteinian space-time continuum that interrupts either. Because King is anticipating his death in the future, what I call the future moral anterior, what will have been true about his death and what should have been true about his death once it occurred, but the death is in the future. But the act that he's imagining in the future is the precipice upon which he stands to look back on the past. Kind of Ray Bradbury moment right there, you know? Maybe Isaac Asimov, Octavia Butler. This prolepsis, this anticipation of what will come, the death that will arrive, and how could he not have a sense of premonition the night before he was murdered? Is it hard to have a sense of premonition when every day somebody's trying to kill you? Every speech may be your last. Every deliverance and gesture to suppose and suggest that America has failed to meet its obligation to the poor that comes through your voice may be the last words you speak, because America just can't tolerate the truth. Truth! It's a Jack Nicholson moment. You can't handle the truth. Okay, maybe a Tom Cruise moment. A few good men and women. And so Martin Luther King Jr. is struggling. Funds drying up for his organization for the first time in a decade, no longer viewed by the Gallup poll as one of the 10 most admired Americans. No American university would extend a lecture invitation to him, and no American publisher wanted to publish his book. He was sociologically and politically dead before he was physically dead. People think now that Martin Luther King Jr. always enjoyed the unalloyed celebration of American society, and yet he was seen as a pariah in white America. And then he was seen and smelled as the malodorous presence in the nostrils of American democracy. But once the sweet scent of martyrdom came, it swept away all of that odor. In an instant, he went from a nuisance to an icon. So the white brothers and sisters want him in his death clawless, and black folk want him flawless. White brothers and sisters in Maine, in general, during that time, wanted to sweeten the danger. He was considered by the second in command of the FBI as the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in America. They understood just how dangerous he was. Sometimes your enemies can determine who you are better than your friends. I heard a preacher preach once, Manuel Scott, that he wanted to preach the fifth gospel. Not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but just what his enemies said about him. He said, if you take what Jesus' enemies said about him, it turns vicious gossip into saving gospel. I know we ain't at a Baptist church. If I was, somebody might say amen. And so he said, if you take what his enemies said about him, never a man spake like this man. You know how black preachers do it. Recently, it has come to the fore. How some black preachers do it. And then he said, never a man spake like this man. That's what his enemy said. So he said, if you go through the Bible and see what the enemy said, they testify more strongly to the resident genius of a prophet whose blood spilled onto the ground, and yet sprang from that blood and that ground a religion that has lasted for thousands of years. And similarly, this prophet who lost his life on a desolate balcony in Memphis, Tennessee, where the report rang out across the Memphis sky, and that lethal projectile found its target with accuracy, tearing a wound into his neck from which flowed the blood as he was knocked back against the wall and then slumped down onto the ground. And his feet, one observer said, like a bicycling wheel through the banister. And as his blood coagulated on that infamous spot that now remains sacred because the prophet surrendered his life there, Ralph Abernathy, his friend, took a cardboard from a shirt and then grabbed the blood of King into a jar and said, this is the blood of Martin shed for us. There, this prophet lost his life. And from his blood being mixed with the soil of American imagination sprang from it the projection of Martin Luther King Jr. as this grand American figure. But many white brothers and sisters clapped when he was murdered, applauded when it happened, celebrated it. We tend to forget that now. Hence, they want to make him clawless because in exchange for celebrating him, he has offered lesser victories in death than what he sought in life. Not radical reorganization of American society, a national holiday instead. Not justice, your birthday being enshrined. Martin Luther King Jr. wouldn't want that. He'd want justice to roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. He'd want poor black people to be embraced, and poor white people from Appalachia, and Native Americans, and First Nation peoples, and Asian brothers and sisters, and poor people across the board, regardless of their identities, Latinos who are recently arrived immigrants, he want all of them together to be able to participate in American culture at the highest possible level. And so I talk about that death because white brothers and sisters wanted him clawless, and black folk wanted him flawless. Perceiving the unprincipled assault upon Dr. King, they felt that the investment in his perfection was the only antidote to his being besmirched in the American imagination. The problem with that, of course, is that they exaggerate the lineaments, the outlines of Dr. King's perfection, and therefore draw sharp contrast unfairly to those who came after. and even sometimes to hold Dr. King as perfect while beating up on young people now who are said not to measure up, falsely identifies him with a perfection he neither wanted nor achieved, and demonizes young people in far greater magnitude than they even deserve. And the investment of many black people in King's perfection discourages young people from seeing that they can be like King if they want to. And so this investment in King's perfection, his flawlessness, is flawed and fails to measure the magnitude of his greatness. And in the second section, I look at the promised land. If Moses, Dr. King dangerously identifies with Moses, I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. Shall we then? 40 years now, isn't that a resonant time? He's now been longer dead than he was alive. 40 years in the wilderness, the children of Israel, Exodus. You can't help but identify with those religious images, even if you don't happen to subscribe individually or particularly to their powerful resonance in your life or your faith tradition. 40 years. Are we any closer? If you black and you got money, you're closer. If you're well off, if you're the elite and you got social prominence, you're good. But if you're poor and black and working class, you're in trouble. And there's a yawning chasm between the black have-gots and the black have-nots. I don't think Dr. King invested in comedians going around the country beating up on poor folk. I don't think that was King's way. And isn't it interesting that many elements of white America finds the bitter and rancorous assault upon the most vulnerable of our nation, tough love and prophetic truth when spoken against black people, but when a prophet from Chicago speaks equally in bitter tones against the dominant white supremacy of the culture, he's seen as a bigot and an opponent to truth. Isn't that interesting? Same tone, different object of derision. And black people ourselves take especial delight in a kind of pornographic public exposure of pathology only when it is associated with poor folk. Get real defensive when it's associated with some rich folk and some famous folk. Don't be messing with our people, but only when they're famous. Shaniqua and Taliqua can't get no love. And yet, in my own accounting, it is when people ascend the heights of economic opportunity that the possibility of expanded sin becomes resonant. Certain things you can't do unless you got dough and cash and capital and opportunity. You can't even do that if you demobilize and poll, but if you can get around and be mobile, you got grand opportunity to engage in all form of nefarious activity. The recent governor of New York has so testified. See, black folks say, you ain't gonna catch us, brother. I'm gonna tell my stuff beforehand. 10 years ago, I did three of them right there on the steps of the Capitol, then on the back. Yep, that's me. And he got so deep, he outed his wife. She did something too. Hey, she messed up too. Honey, that's so gauche. There might be more coming. He couldn't see it coming, but he said he knew it was happening. And so here we are with this class cleavage, this yawning abyss, this chasm between the have-gots and the have-nots. And who's in the promised land? Those of us who got a foot there, those of us who have inched there, those with a niche of protection are there. But we leave vulnerable the rest, and we feel justified in berating them. And then I end, as I will here with this speech, with the Joshuas, those messianic Christian figures who have emerged in the aftermath of Dr. King's life, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Al Sharpton, and Senator Barack Obama. And Jesse Jackson has been much maligned, dismissed. Dr. King was famous in public with a career that lasted for nearly 12 years. Jesse Jackson has had to hold on for 40. Now, when one considers the alternative, die at 39 and be enshrined and live and try to work out one's soul salvation, the latter, of course, is the preference. But let's be honest. Frozen into a youthful posture of perfection will always trump people in an age of YouTube and 24-hour news networks that expose all your flaws. Had King lived, his would have been exposed too. Would he have been celebrated as he is now? Of course not. 80 years old, he would have been seen as a slow-talking, southern cadence, black preacher who can't get along with the new figure like Barack Obama. Barack Obama might have to distance himself from Martin Luther King Jr. too. Isn't that interesting? But alas, I get ahead of myself a bit, but I wanted to foreshadow that for your titillation. Jesse Jackson makes love in language, his undulating cadences, the sensuous character of the words, the neologisms and the new catchphrases and the gut bucket gutturalisms and the country preacher poetics, mixed with the edifying language drawn from the King's English to the Queen's taste. He is able to range in dense and deep data and empirical verification of his point, and at the same time tell stories illuminated through tropes and metaphors drawn from the vernacular of black speech. He has had to articulate a vision over and against the rise of black power and its decline, white backlash, black narcissism, cultural narcissism, the age of crack, the rise of hip-hop, the so-called post-racial era, the post-civil rights era, the retrenchment of conservative loyalties, the rise of the conservative radical right junta, and still holds on. Running for the presidency twice, people say that Mr. Obama is the first serious one. We know that Jesse Jackson was really the first serious one. He won primaries. Now, nothing, of course, has been able to eclipse what Mr. Obama has now recently done. But Jesse Jackson was a forerunner in a very serious way. The reason Mr. Obama is able to be graceful and lucid and therefore rational and calm is because Jesse Jackson had to be a bit more angry and a bit more vituperative, but also assertive in a way that was read as arrogant by many, but now in comparison to recent evocations of black religious discourse, seem outright tame. Furthermore, Jesse Jackson had to be the lineman who opened the hole so that Barack Obama could run gracefully through it. Al Sharpton has come along. People seem to be fascinated with his mane. They want to conk him because of his conk. They don't because of his do. Well, those of us who are familiar with the story know that Reverend Sharpton was mentored by James Brown. And the only promise Mr. Brown extracted from Reverend Sharpton was to wear his hair like his till he died. Now the call has echoed across the horizon now. He's dead. He's dead. But if Mr. Sharpton were to show up with a fro right now, it might be downright stunning and maybe even shocking. He has follicle fidelity. And I dare you to take a silhouette of Mr. Sharpton and place it in juxtaposition to George Washington. New meanings to Whigs and Tories, and quite similar. He took it old school. He also speaks out against the two things for which he has been most especially noted, police brutality and white racist hate groups' assaults upon black people. The recent Sean Bell incident, where black life has been reinforced as worth little, would we tolerate this if Jewish or Italian or Polish or Lithuanian brothers and sisters at such a consistent and constant rate were always found to be likely to have committed a crime potentially without any contravening evidence or weapon in the place? Would this be tolerable? And would we be calm and rational in the face of the death. Black death, the tradition in which King's assassination must be placed. Lynching, assassinations, murders, castrations. The point of a lynching was to reinforce the supremacy and superiority of white power, as I close, even as it reinforced the vulnerability of black life. The assassination did that one better by taking a symbolic figure to reinforce the vulnerability of the masses. I know that message got home to me. I was 9 years old when King was murdered, and yet when he was murdered, for a year or two, I could not walk by my bathroom window as a child because it had a curtain there that was open, and it was a balcony on the second floor, thinking that someone would murder me. That's how vulnerable I felt. If they murdered him and he meant nothing but good for America, why would they spare me? The psychic grief that lay in the aftermath of King's death was both colossal and mostly unobserved by dominant culture. And yet, it was compressed into burning riots in 110 cities in the aftermath of the prophet's death, but also in the collective grief of black America and its skepticism about the possibility of overcoming and getting to the promised land. So that Barack Obama has been anointed or appointed, depending upon one's religious orientation or secular bearing, as the carrier of that tradition. And yet, ironically enough, he can only be so if he is in explicit opposition to the civil rights tradition. He is celebrated as being the un-Sharpton, the anti-Jackson. The reason that white America is said to be comfortable with Barack is because he's uncomfortable with them. And yet, like a ghost of the Christmas past, those black prophetic presences just keep hobgobbling along. And the pastor who brought him to Jesus now has brought him to judgment. And it's interesting, as I end my brief talk here, that Martin Luther King Jr., had you two been around, might have been similarly seen as the source of subversive sentiments. He said one thing to black America and another to white, not altogether different, but different tone and style, and presumption that he could be open and honest in a way that he couldn't in white America. In other words, you know, all communities develop inside language, codes, stuff that allows you to compress language, and you ain't got to express everything and explain everything because y'all be knowing what y'all talking about because y'all in the same group, part of the same sorority or fraternity, part of the same tribe or the ethnic or racial clan. So it's interesting that black folk got kicked out of white churches, Absalom Jones and Richard Allen. But when you divorce somebody, you really can't tell them who to date. Those men who try that, mostly them, are seen rightfully so as domestic terrorists who feel a sense of ownership in a patriarchal worldview that gives them the right to murder women who used to be connected to them because of that sense of ownership. Apply that analogy to what goes on in racial groups, especially between black and white. And the way in which black people have dissented from the larger mainstream tradition. Now we develop our own churches and our own styles, and the folk who, a couple 300 years ago, who didn't want us in the churches now get awful upset because we actually say stuff in those churches that may be perceived as antithetical to their best interests. That's only natural. You kick me out, I might talk about you a little bit. Ain't nothing mean, because most black folk, we just so loving and forgiving. Didn't you see John McCain go to Memphis and stand there? And boy, he knew he was going to get it. You got to get a brother love. He stood there and the black folks, no, boo. And you heard a black one, that's all right, baby. You go ahead on now. We forgive you. I love black people. And so as I end, Martin Luther King Jr., when he spoke to black folks, spoke in a different way sometimes. He said stuff that he said to white America, but even more on steroids, so to speak. He said, for instance, that the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is America. He said that in white America, but he said it especially pungently in black America. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world, King said in his sermon, Drum Major Instinct. The imperialistic tentacles of America suck the blood from nations throughout the world. Sound familiar? King said that America was founded in genocide. King said that he was tired of being on the reservation. Japanese brothers and sisters had been interned in concentration camps, and he didn't want to be done like that, and they might do it to black people too. 67, and in 68, he said that to black folk, and then found among his effects, crumpled in his pocket as he lay dying on that concrete, were the notes for his next Sunday's sermon, Why America May Go to Hell. And so Martin Luther King Jr. would certainly have been seen as a source of subversive sentiments in a similar fashion as to Reverend Wright. Be careful about drawing historical parallels suggesting that Obama is King and Wright is not. Obama is Martin Luther King Jr. from the beginning of his career to 1965, Mr. Wright from 65 on. They are the split mind of Martin Luther King Jr. about the status of black people and his perspective on race. And in broad stroke, they represent the continual evolution of this dual prism through which we view our lives in America. Ever hopeful, we need Barack Obama to portray what should be. And we need Jeremiah Wright to remind us of what has been and what we must overcome to get there. Those are the twin foci, the twin prisms through which we view it. And Martin Luther King Jr. still speaks to us from his grave and from the vantage point of the enormous perch that he occupies in America. But we have engaged in a serious act of amnesia to neglect and forget his most radical legacy. His death, April 4th, is Easter, Good Friday, Resurrection. January 15th is his birth, Christmas. We got to deal with the blood and brutality to get to the celebration and the icon. Thank you so very kindly.
Thank you. Our thanks to Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and author of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm president of Sierra Steel Trading. I'm a past president of the Board of Governors and current member of the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club of California. And Dr. Dyson, we have many, many questions here for you. So you mentioned that Martin Luther King is a prophet. Mm-hmm. And I just picked something up from your last comment, that he has influence even today in his death. So this question talks about the fact that Muslims see Abraham, they see Jesus, and they see Muhammad as prophets. Do you see Martin Luther King in a similar way to that?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. Martin Luther King Jr. has ascended to the heights of both American and national consciousness, but also global consciousness. He has inspired people of every faith and nations around the globe because of the incredible sacrificial life that he led. I happen to think that King was the greatest American who ever walked this soil, greater than Jefferson and greater than Lincoln, because they possessed the bully pulpit of the American presidency to articulate their vision. King was without portfolio. He was a private citizen, never elected to office, and yet from that vantage point of vulnerability, he changed the world. And I think he embodies the best ideas of this democracy, and even further, as Abraham and Isaiah and Jeremiah and all of the great prophets of all great religion, I think he stands as a resonant symbol of the best that human beings can achieve when the ideas for which they are willing to sacrifice their lives converge with the best traditions of civic virtue and with religious passion. So, yes, I would definitely place him in that number.
I have many T-shirts that I wear, and one in particular is one of my favorites. And in the back it says, "Speak truth to power." I never know what that meant until I started reading your book. And so I did some research, and here's what I found out. My research showed that
the Quakers
found a way to define the rejection of mass violence and to replace it with practical demonstrations of the effectiveness of love in human relations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how accurate what I read is, but how did Dr. King use the concept of speaking truth to power in his speeches and writings and in bringing social justice to blacks in America?
Well, he brought it not only to eloquent question, he brought it not only to blacks in America, most especially he brought it to white brothers and sisters as well, and to the dominant culture in America and to all Americans. We can't quarantine his greatness to his pigment or his skin or his tribe. He transformed the possibility of what it meant to be an American. He spoke truth to power because he was elegant and consistent in demanding that people love each other, but that they deal with the bitter bigotries and the precincts of prejudice that prevailed and the systemic inequities that prevented people from flourishing. King said to the journalist David Halberstam in 1967 in a Harper's Magazine article that, "I used to think you could change a little bit over here and a little bit over there, but then I began to see you got to change the whole system. We have to have a restructuring of American society. We must have a transformation of American values, a revolution of values." Long before virtuocrats like Bill Bennett began to pipe up about virtuocracy, Martin Luther King Jr. articulated its possibility and its necessity, but not in narrow terms. So his truth to power was speaking as a concerned, conscientious citizen to the powers that be, and to demand that love be the practice of American culture, but not a kind of namby-pamby love. He made a distinction, as the Greeks did, between philia, agape, and eros. And he said that ultimate love ain't about feeling good about somebody. You don't feel good about somebody who wants to kill you, murder you, lynch you, and strangle you. He said it was deep and abiding love. And ultimately, justice is what love sounds like when it speaks in public. So he pursued justice not as a substitute but as an extension of love. And speaking truth to power meant that he would never neglect the reality that those who had concentrated power in their hands had often worked against the best interests of the vulnerable, and he had to speak out on their behalf. That's how he was able to exercise his legitimate moral authority against even greater powers in the state to effect serious and lasting and substantive social change.
Someone in the audience remembers another event in 1968. It's the moment where Dr. John Carlos and Tommy Smith on the victory stand at the Olympics raised their hand with black gloves. I'm wondering, this person asks, who Martin Luther King Jr.'s Peter Norman was. Those people who supported King through his depressions, through the death threats, women we haven't heard about, the invisible merit women.
The invisible
merit.
M-E-R-I, the college merit? What?
So is it the people we haven't heard about and supported?
People that we haven't heard
the
about.
Invisible men and women who.
I guess.
Oh, the word
yeah,
is
yeah.
Men, right.
Yeah, yeah, no. Great point. Great question. You know what? Martin Luther King Jr. felt awfully alone. The testimony of some of his closest aide said that he was very lonely at the end because there were very few people to whom he could turn, with whom he could share his feelings. Even his greatest friend, Ralph Abernathy, his closest friend in the world, his partner in jail, bless you, felt very close to him but was also jealous of him. You know, when they went to Oslo, Norway to get the Nobel Prize, Mr. Abernathy wanted to ride up front in the car, and he wasn't riding up front, and he wanted half the money. And, you know, don't be so hard on him. You know, brother out there, look, man, they shooting at me too, bro. I don't care what you do with yours. I need half that dough right there. That's me. You know what I'm saying? Holler at your boy. And he loved him like none other, but he also was resentful that he wasn't featured. And then when he got to be the featured player in the, you know, the major dramatis persona, he couldn't carry it because that wasn't his role. Ed McMahon ain't always trying to be Johnny Carson. Can't be. That's different than Tonto being Lone Ranger, though. Because Tonto just needed a shot. Who you talking about, Kemo Sabe? Then we who, right? So I don't have time to deconstruct that. But the point is, the African proverb says when, you know, as you heard a preacher say recently, that as long as the hunter is telling the story, it's going to be one thing. But let the hunted start telling the story. The lion starts speaking up. That's going to be a different history. But having said that, he had very few people to whom he could turn. Imagine that. You know, he had relationships beyond the pale of his legitimate, sanctified, sanctioned primary relationship. I'll say it that way. And 28 days of the year, of the month, he's away from home. He's being threatened every day. He turns to episodic interventions to relieve the pain. He speaks to others who might understand, but they really don't. He was increasingly isolated and alone with very few people to talk to. That's part of the tragedy. But there are so many others who provided succor and comfort in ways that, for obvious reasons, have not altogether come forth, though one has in a book called I Shared the Dream, as you can imagine, a state senator from Kentucky.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and author of April 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. Dr. Dyson, you talked about several other black leaders in the United States. You mentioned Jesse Jackson, Ralph Abernathy, Al Sharpton. There's a few more here I would like you to comment on, if you would, please. And maybe compare and contrast, for example, Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X, as well as Louis Farrakhan.
Well, if we take the Nation of Islam tradition, so we'll include Farrakhan, we'll include Elijah Muhammad, we'll include Malcolm X. Obviously, there was an extraordinary usefulness to the Nation of Islam trajectory of leadership. That triumvirate in particular has added gloriously and infamously, some would argue, to the stakes of black leadership, because what they have understood in concert is the necessity of rehabilitating the black psyche. At a time when black people didn't feel good about themselves, know much about themselves, didn't think that the pedagogy of oppression, or more specifically, the pedagogy of their own people, the history, the stories, the traditions, the narratives, the beauty, that was extremely important and taught black America that we should embrace and love each other. And they pushed Martin Luther King Jr. to do so. King started going around saying, I got good hair too. Now, black folk get that point. I don't want to have time to break that down for the white folk. Good hair? What's good hair? I'll tell you what good hair is. When you tell it to stay in place, it stays there. That's good hair. Obey, Bobo. So turn to your black neighbor and ask him what that means later. So King said, I'm black and beautiful. He began to appreciate that his kinky hair was beautiful, though it wasn't the flowing locks of white America. And he said, my dark skin is beautiful, too. That is a direct attribute of the Nation of Islam and Elijah and Malcolm and so on. But I will say this in closing about Malcolm X. I love Malcolm X. My second book was about Malcolm X. He's a great genius. He did something King didn't do in leaving a testimony, a document, a story, a narrative that has fueled the imaginations and inspired generations after him. But one deficit, I think, in Malcolm is that he stood in the womb of Harlem speaking negatively about King as the greatest Uncle Tom in America and the greatest weapon the white man has ever had. He's wrong. And furthermore, you in Harlem. The fight is down in Birmingham. Take 500 Fruit of Islam, go down to Birmingham, and if you whip Bull Connor's assets out of him, the next day, assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum salam. Don't tell me about how he was being a coward, Minister Malcolm, when you wouldn't even test the metal and durability of your theory, because Bull Connor might have murdered all of you. A bloodbath King understood. So he did something even deeper. He got inside through nonviolence and, like Samson, began to kill the people, the prejudice and the bigotry from within by pushing its boundaries from within. Malcolm was not nearly as subversive or radical or dangerous as Martin Luther King Jr. was.
And let's not forget about Louis Farrakhan.
I added him into all of those.
Okay. Thank you. One more. The Black Panthers. Is there a relationship with Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers?
Yeah. I mean, Stokely Carmichael is the linchpin, so to speak, because Stokely Carmichael, for a moment, I think was involved with the Panthers, certainly with SNCC, one of the authors of Black Power. And by the way, the reason I didn't answer that Farrakhan question, we ain't got enough time or opportunity to deconstruct that, so I don't want to get caught in no narrow niche. As we saw yesterday, that can be ugly. But Farrakhan has added immeasurably to the stakes of Black leadership and offered Black people a very powerful expression for their griefs and the hostilities that they confront. For Black people, Farrakhan's usefulness is not determined by his relationship to anti-Semitic statements or the determination by the mainstream that he has made them, but by his willingness to courageously and fearlessly stand up before white America to speak his truth to that power. There's a lot more to be said, with which I disagree, and got called by Minister Farrakhan to his house to meet with him, knowing I had been critical of him. And he said, "I know, my brother. That's why I want to talk to you." And then I spoke to him for 3.5 hours. That's another lecture. So the Black Panthers certainly were a tremendous group. Fred Hampton in Chicago, cut down, murdered, assassinated, really, by police officials. Black Panthers, for the most part, with breakfast programs, deriving from this area, a tremendous resource for rebellion against white supremacy, and also obviously internal and internecine squabbles and internal problems that also undermined them and led to their demise. But it's easy to give in to problems that lead to your demise when the government is infiltrating your organization and subverting it. Martin Luther King Jr. believed in Black power, but not necessarily the phrase at the beginning, because he thought it was counterproductive and didn't lead ultimately to the transformative possibilities of Black power. But he did say 10 days before he was murdered to a rabbinical assembly of America, where he was introduced by Abraham Joshua Heschel as the moral leader of America, that Black people should be careful lest they integrate themselves out of power. You got your own little stuff over here. Be careful before you integrate that you don't lose what you do have, trying to get what you ain't got, and then when you get over there, you ain't got nothing and you done lost what you had. All right.
Dr. Dyson, we want to cover at least two more topics before we close for the night.
Mm-hmm.
First one, the role of Black churches. What is the role of Black churches to define the current state of affairs of African Americans in the United States? Which ministers, preachers, or other church leaders, in your view, take a leading role nationally?
Oh, boy. That's a lecture right there. Well, obviously, the prophetic Black church has been important. It's not the dominant tradition in Black America, but it has been the most influential. It's been the militant minority, the radical remnant. Martin Luther King Jr. was a part of it. So was Reverdy Ransom. So was Vashti McKenzie years ago. So was Denmark Vesey and Gabriel Prosser and Nat Turner. So the prophetic Black church, to me, is the one that speaks truth to power, that says to Pharaoh, "Let my people go," that seizes upon biblical narratives and religious traditions and narratives and voices and experiences as the basis for expressing social outrage and public grievance with inequities wherever they exist. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was fired from his position as the vice president of the National Baptist Convention by a conservative Black preacher. So there are internecine squabbles. There are internal divisions within Black America about the best route. The Jeremiah Wrights of the world just emerged. We've been hearing about Creflo Dollar and T.D. Jakes for a long time, right? So those are the major voices, and they're acceptable and palatable because they don't challenge the status quo, and they really reproduce the pathogen of capital and entrepreneurial evangelism, that is Creflo Dollar, T.D. Jakes is a rhetorical genius who articulates an extraordinary capacity for psychological reconstruction and spiritual rehabilitation. But he has not been known to challenge the status quo to the degree and extent that he would alienate white brothers and sisters in the way that Dr. King did, though he obviously understands the need to address men through his ministry in prison and to deal with the wounds and hurts of black women. So he's been of invaluable resource to black America. But there are other prophetic traditions which are masked, marginal, and then therefore left invisible. And when they do emerge, as we've seen in recent days, there's a lot of trouble in the offing. Charles Adams, Freddie Haynes, Lance Watson, Jeremiah Wright, Vashti McKenzie, Carolyn Knight, and William Curtis, and on and on and on.
When they were candidates, Senator John Kerry, Senator John Edwards spent quite a bit of time in black churches to get out the black vote. Do you think Senator Obama will do the same, or has the bad publicity centered around Reverend Jeremiah Wright about Obama's membership made black churches too much of a hotspot for him?
Well, the black church is coming to him, clearly. He ain't got to go there. It's portable, peripatetic, mobile. And if you really believe in God, is everywhere you gather when you believe in God at that point. That's what a black church is. Black church could be up in here tonight. Mm-hmm. So... I think, as I understand the black church, not brick and mortar, orientation, perspective, acceptability. And there are many more traditions. There are many multiple prophetic traditions. You saw one in Jeremiah Wright. There are others, some less acerbic, less sardonic, less witty, less brilliant, less rhetorically sophisticated. That's one expression of a prophetic tradition and stream, but it's a powerful one. And it was YouTubed to death now and soundbited to death. And now it begins to pour forward and it creates difficulties. But the prophetic church has always done that and it must always do so. So I don't think it's too much of a hotspot. I think people with understanding comprehend that the black church will be present because there's so many different manifestations of the black church. And black love will cover Mr. Obama. Even people who are perceived to be on the outs because of their religious beliefs will pray for the brother and see him as an extension of God's will and grace in human community, even as he makes statements that judge his pastor. But his pastor, in anticipation, said that as a politician, this is what he might have to do. So as they speak to each other, and what choice did he have, some would argue, and then what choice did Wright have in being besmirched in character to say what he said? It's a very tenuous route. It does test black America's commitment to understanding that when you got black folk on both teams, who do you root for? You know, that old saw that said when Tubby Smith and, what's my man's name? Tony Dungy, and they were saying, who you for? Who you want to win? They said the black coach. Because one of them was going to win. I don't think that's quite what they can say right now, who you want to win, the black person. Well, Obama and Wright are both that. But there's a different stake here. And so it tests the durability and feasibility of our racial commitments and contracts. And are we really post-racial or are we centered in race? We'll continue to decide that. And I think ultimately, however, the black church ain't going to give up on Barack Obama. They will find a way to pray for that brother, stretch out God, his long arm of protection and her long arm protection around him and give him safe journey as he makes his way to the White House. They will continue to pray for that brother, that will be the end. That wasn't a prayer I was given unless you receive it that way.
I want to get a quick two questions in before we close for the evening. How can Latino leadership and the Latino population in America today promote the truth that Martin Luther King Jr. dreamed for African Americans and for America? Wow. How can Latinos capture this for themselves?
Right, by looking at the tradition of a King or a Cesar Chavez or Jose Marti. It is to look at the extraordinary capacity of Latinos to come to this country to regenerate its economic possibilities. Despite this anti-immigrant fervor, they have infused this country with vitality and vigor and vision and a kind of virtue that is really underappreciated but overexploited. So I think they can look toward their instincts to band together as they did 400,000 strong to say, we ain't going to work today to show you just how powerful we are. More of that and more of that unity will resonate with the kind of tradition that Dr. King did so we can be truly e pluribus unum out of many one.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached that point in the program where there's time for just one last question. And I'm going to ask for an answer in percentages. Question is, if you could quantify where we were in terms of race relations during the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr. and where we should aspire to be, how much progress would you say that we have made?
About 23%.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, renowned academic, public intellectual, and author of April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Joe Epstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.